I'm wearing fur pajamas. I ride a hot potato. It's tickling my fancy. Speak up, I can't hear you. Here on this mountaintop, whoa, I got some wild, wild life. I got some news to tell you about some wild, wild life. Here comes the doctor in charge, whoa. She's got some wild, wild life. Ain't that the way you like it, whoa. Living wild, wild life. I wrestle with your conscience. You wrestle with your partner sitting on a window still. Oh, but he spends his time behind closed doors. Check out Mr. Businessman. Oh, he bought some wild, wild life on the way to the stock exchange. Oh, he got some wild, wild life. Break it up when it opens the door. Oh,
Wild, Wild Life from the film True Stories, a song by the Talking Heads. But instead of John Goodman lip-singing, that was the great Charles Lincoln in his very own voice.
Trying to do several voices, actually, but I don't know how convincing it was. It was not just John Goodman, of course, in that song. That's what I was saying. It was a whole bunch of people. John Goodman's song was a different one that I'll sing later on in the show. And it's a good place to wrap up with. But I've got to ask you, Robert, why do you want to talk about the weirdest show ever made about a metropolitan area and specifically the culture of a very unique metropolitan area in the United States?
Well, the film True Stories, it's about a small town, a fictional small town, but I'm sure it's inspired. I'm sure there's a lot of small towns in Texas that are just like that, on the outskirts of Dallas. But
it's specifically about the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. There are scenes at North Park Mall. There are all sorts of scenes that are totally recognizable to anybody who ever lived in Dallas.
The film was directed by David Byrne of the Talking Heads, and he also does the music for the film. But basically, the theme, it came out in 1986, and it's sort of about the contrast of how the town is changing, and it kind of shows both worlds, and I think that's also kind of the significance of that era, the 1980s in American history.
Well, 1986. I was 26 years old, and it was very
1 year old.
Well, I was not your father, just for the records. I take no responsibility for you. But anyhow, I was definitely old enough to be your father. But what I was going to say is 1986 was a very significant year in the state of Texas because it was, in fact, the sesquicentennial, the 150th anniversary of the Texas Revolution, and it was celebrated very widely throughout the state of Texas and got tremendous press everywhere. The 150th anniversary of the war with Santa Ana, the Alamo, all these great moments, it was the year that Bill Clements beat Mark White, pretty much finally perfecting Texas status as a red Republican state, solid red Republican state. It had gone back and forth.
Oh, hold on, I got Robert Lindsay right here. Robert Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Hello there.
Hey, Robert, how are you doing?
Can I
call you Lindsay on this short so we don't get confused about who's Robert and who's you?
Yeah, you can call me anything you want.
Well, I don't want to think of anything too descriptive, but how about Lindsay?
Yeah, that's fine, yeah.
How are you doing? A long time no see since Fresno.
I'm doing all right, I guess.
How's life in Fresno?
Madeira.
Well, you're close.
Okay.
You're like within about an hour of Fresno, right?
Yeah. I don't really care where I live, you know. I mean, that's my idea. To me, all towns are the
same. Lindsay, have you seen that film, True Stories, by the Talking Heads?
No.
You haven't? Did you miss my song? Should I sing it again? Robert, you didn't let me play it, you know.
I heard it.
Oh, you heard it. Okay.
Yeah.
Just for the record, I didn't finish it. I was only about halfway done.
So, the theme of the movie is, it's very much so they're celebrating the anniversary of Texas independence.
The 150th anniversary, and what they use very interesting Texas accents in the show, and they specifically play on one particular pronunciation, which is the sesquicentennial of specialness. Specialness.
The Texas accent is very interesting. It's not a generic Texas accent.
I don't really think I have a Texas accent. I mean, I think you can pick up little...
It's kind of a hybrid of a bunch of different stuff. It's like part like aristocratic Southern accent, part like Harvard accent. It's just a whole hodgepodge of stuff.
Well, I'm afraid that's the story of my life, boy. I've lived all over. To quote a character in True Stories... I've been everywhere, and I've done everything. That's actually a line from True Stories. The character who delivers that particular line is known only by her epithet, the lying woman. Whatever the scene is, she comes in and tells absolutely preposterous stories. She said that she had an affair with Burt Reynolds, that the Warren Commission paid her to be quiet about the Kennedy assassination, that she was born with a tail that had to be cut off. It's a truly amazing story, and I guess that's why they call it True Stories, is because Texas is a state where traditionally truth really is stranger than fiction. Robert or Lindsay, do you think that California is ever quite that weird?
California's always that weird.
Okay, so you think you could make an equivalent movie about a coherent story about California where people who work together are just indescribably weird?
Well, that's California.
Okay, you said you haven't seen this movie, so I guess it's hard to. We should have made you watch it before you see it. I think that, you know, Robert and I talked about doing this show because I was recently in Texas because my mother passed away, and I hadn't spent any time in Texas in a very long time, and it was a very sad occasion, and getting together with family members and friends and, you know, going places that were scenes of my childhood that I hadn't been for years. One of the weirdest scenes that I think hit me the very first weekend I was there, the very first Sunday I was there anyhow, was I went to the church where I had been a choir boy, you know, an embarrassingly large number of decades ago, the Church of the Incarnation over on McKinney in what's now all called Uptown Dallas, and... The thing that shocked me the most, several things shocked me, but one of them was that Texas's reputation as a police state was exemplified there. Have you ever been to a church where armed, uniformed policemen are guarding literally every entrance, every doorway, every access, every sidewalk of the church?
Well, that's really weird.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I have seen that with, like, Jewish synagogues, but I've never, ever seen that in a church in L.A.
Now, that's interesting at Jewish synagogues. I mean, this is the Church of the Incarnation. It is one of the wealthiest congregations in the United States. It's the only Episcopal church.
To the degree of All Saints in Beverly Hills?
All Saints in Beverly Hills is a dying congregation. Incarnation is growing by leaps and bounds, maybe even by beeps and bounds. And even the evening service on Sunday is absolutely the evening prayer service is absolutely crowded. They have just finished and are in the process right now of opening two gigantic new wings of the church. It's physically the largest Episcopal church in the state of Texas, the largest congregation anywhere west of the Mississippi. I would guess that it's actually a lot wealthier than All Saints in Beverly Hills. I mean, you know, it's not like I can go through the roster of the congregation and see the net wealth of each person. I don't have that kind of access to information, but...
I guess in Beverly Hills, Episcopalians are a dispossessed minority.
Yeah, they really are, and I mean, it's just, they can barely fill the church on Christmas Eve at All Saints on Santa Monica in Beverly Hills.
Well, but there is a church in the movie, but it's not necessarily like an Episcopal church, but it's more...
It's not like any church in the entire world.
Inspiration is from those 1980s kind of televangelists, but what's interesting is the preacher is into a lot of that conspiracy stuff that you hear, like, from maybe Alex Jones, like the Trilateral Commission, the Illuminati. But the thing that's interesting is back...
Shall I quote from the sermon?
I want to make a point. First is back then, that type of stuff was not so widespread. It was considered very kind of fringe. It didn't become as widespread until recently with, like, the alternative media and Internet.
Oh, yeah, because we didn't really have an Internet back in the 80s.
I can quote the sermon. Yeah, go ahead.
You got the CBS and the ABC. You got Time and Newsweek. Well, they're the same to me. Now, don't you want to get right with me? Puzzling evidence. I hope you get everything you need. Puzzling evidence. Puzzling evidence. Done hardened in your heart. Hardened in your heart, all right. Now, I'm the gun and you're the bullet. I got the power and the glory. Puzzling and the money to buy it. Puzzling. Got your Gulf and Western and your MasterCard. Puzzling evidence. You got what you wanted, lost what you had. Puzzling evidence. I'm seeing puzzling evidence. Done hardened in your heart. It's hardened in your heart, all right.
Nice.
You ever hear a sermon like that in either Fresno or Madero?
No.
I think they have them around here, something like that.
And then with the characters, I guess I'll go over the characters. So one of the primary characters, his name is Louis Fine. He's played by John Goodman. And
yes. He's
a country musician, but he's also, he's unlucky in love. And in the opening scene, it shows his house, and he has like a giant, like Las Vegas-style sign in front of his house saying, searching for a wife.
Yes. And that is the running the central story. In terms of what the movie's about, one song that pretty much puts it all together is called "Love for Sale," and that sign of John Goodman's is he's seeking love. And oddly enough, if one way of looking at the story without giving too much away. And believe it or not, hardly giving anything away, no matter how much we talk about it, he basically ends up being bought. He lives the American dream. He gets married to a wealthy widow. who never gets out of bed. Isn't that every American?
She's not terminally ill. She's just lazy.
Yeah, exactly. She's never gotten out of bed because she's so rich she doesn't have to.
And I guess that's maybe accurate. The rich in California are very into like fitness and working out and jogging. Maybe that's accurate for some of the rich in Texas.
I'm not sure that accuracy is like the key focus of this movie. I think that metaphor for culture in trauma is the key metaphor of this movie. People who've lost all their traditional values and haven't gotten any new ones yet. Because remember, Louis Fine actually is a computer geek. He works for Ross Perot. As a matter of fact, he works for Ross Perot's own company, whose name I can't even remember right now. But they mentioned that at the beginning of the. Of the film that he's working
Texas
for that
Instrument?
Company. Probably TI. I think that was Ross Perot's first company, but can't swear to it off the top of my head. It was never one of my issues. So, I guess one of the interesting things to talk about tonight is. The destruction of traditional culture and the birth of nothing in its place. Lindsay, would you agree with that as a characterization of American dilemma right now?
Possibly. I'm actually concerned more about other things.
What are you concerned about?
I'm really concerned about, like, I just went to San Francisco just the other day.
Just went where?
Well, I was in San Francisco. I was in the Delta. I don't know if you know the Bay Area. I was in Brentwood for a day. It's over by Antioch. And then up to the Napa Valley.
Not Brentwood where I used to live, but there's another Brentwood in Contra Costa County.
And then up to Napa Valley for wine tasting. I've never done that before. And that was pretty fun. And then back down to San Francisco, Golden Gate Park and the Haight. And, you know, I was just thinking... Remember when all those hippies lived in San Francisco in the 67, 68, 69?
Who can
How
forget?
How much did it cost to live in San Francisco back then? I mean, wasn't it the type of town where those hippies could just go and rent a place and it was fairly affordable or something?
It was a city where, you know, you could make a realistic movie about insurance salesmen renting houses up on Knob Hill. I mean,
even if you watch like the Dirty Harry movies with Clint Eastwood that depicts San Francisco in the 70s, those films depict San Francisco as still a very kind of working class city.
And I was thinking about it. Walking down the Haight, and there's all these little shops there, and nobody in those stores is making any money. Really, they're just like baristas or something, they're all just like. Minimum wage employees, basically. Okay, where the hell are they living? Where the hell are they living? You know, I was thinking about L.A. You remember in L.A.? Remember the hippie scene in L.A. and all? Around the same time? I mean, you must have been able to get a fairly cheap apartment in L.A. What's L.A. like? What's New York City like now? There was a punk rock scene in New York City. There must have been fairly affordable apartments. It just seems to me that our cities are getting so expensive that only rich people can live there. That's what I'm saying.
Well, to give you an idea of what it was like in the early 70s anyhow, I went to high school in Los Angeles. My mother and I came from Texas to Los Angeles, and Los Angeles seemed very, very expensive, but... in sorting through my mother's effects after she died, I found the lease she had for the Hollywood bungalow that she rented while I was in high school. And she had this six-room very large Hollywood bungalow, rented out in the early 70s for what seemed to us the astronomical fee. Are you both sitting down? I hope. $125 a month.
Jesus Christ. With inflation, if it was still at $125 a month with inflation, what would that be now? $500 or something like that?
Maybe $600. I mean, inflation's been pretty bad, but even so.
But what would that rent just inflation? I mean, that would be now $2,000-$3,000. You know.
I actually have looked at the exact same place. The exact same place is now going for $7,500 per month.
Jesus Christ!
No.
Jesus Christ! Wow.
One theme in it really talks about the culture of that era. So overall, what is unique? I think what is unique about the 1980s is that it was, you had a remnant of the old America, but you also had sort of the new America coincide with each other. You have the contrast. Today, basically, you don't really have that contrast. You pretty much just have, I don't know the best word to describe it, but Charles, you're a good wordsmith. What word would you use to describe our society today?
Valueless. Cultureless.
Exactly.
Devoid of any sort of coherent meaning or purpose.
I think the fact that we have no culture anymore. I actually like it.
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
I mean, culture is dependent on common language and common understanding to begin with. And the heterogeneity of American society means that it is absolutely impossible to have a common culture, a common language. And True Stories really shows how multiculturalism had altered Texas even by 1986. And I wanted to bring up one of my all-time favorite Western movies to illustrate just what had happened in Texas between 1956 and 1986, a 30-year period. I was born in 1960, so, you know, right in that time period. But the Texas that I was born into was still the Texas of the Old South, where the key myth was, there were two key myths to Texas, or maybe three, and I'd say that those three myths were the myth of the Wild West, hence Wild Wild Life. There was the myth of the South and the Confederate heritage, closely related to the Texas Republican heritage. And then there was the myth of oil wealth, which my family was kind of a part of. Although they were secondary, they were refiners, not drillers. But largely considered John Ford's greatest Western of all, called The Searchers with John Wayne. One of the key lines in that story, which was a tremendous hit in the year that Dwight Eisenhower was elected to his second term, one of the key lines in this story was John Wayne speaking as Ethan, saying, "I figure a man's only good for one oath at a time. I took mine to the Confederate States of America, and so do you, Reverend." It was a Christian white Southern state, and that was its key identity. And by the time, within 30 years, by the time you get to True Stories, you've got Haitian voodoo, you've got New York music coming in, you've got fashion shows with all sorts of weird fashion, and you've got families.
By New York music, are you referring to the Talking Heads?
I'm referring to most of the music that's portrayed at the bar scene and at the North Park Mall karaoke scene. North Park Mall is right next to where my mother used to live, or where my whole family used to live, really, in Island Park. And my mother specifically was living right next to it for most of the last, you know, some odd years of her life. And North Park was just considered the ne plus ultra of malls in the 1960s and 70s of Dallas. And it had become sort of a laughing stock by the time of True Stories. But you had all this cultural diversity.
One thing that is interesting about the film is it depicts cultural diversity, but it kind of depicts it in sort of a small, sort of harmless quantities. Like there's a Haitian voodoo guy, there's a Mexican bar, but it's kind of seen as kind of like in small quantities, it's kind of exotic. But today we just have this massive, overwhelming numbers.
But they do, you know, in between 1956 with The Searchers and John Ford, John Wayne, and, you know, My Only Oath Was to the Confederate States. You know, between that and 1986, the movie mentions several times the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and that really was a watershed in the transformation of Dallas. And it was a major event in the life of every person, even remotely tangentially connected to North Texas, and it comes up in the church scene. It comes up in the summary of Texas history at the beginning, and it's illustrated over and over again as this transformative event. And what is interesting, if you think about it, is in 1963, when Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, it was still very much the white southern state of The Searchers. And in 1965, Mr. Kennedy's heir, Lyndon Johnson, ironically enough, a southern Texan, pushed through the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, and within 21 years, you have baby cultural diversity illustrated as a fact of life throughout Texas. And then, and now, 29 years after that, a total of, 52 years after Kennedy's assassination, you've got Uptown Dallas dominated, except the Church of the Incarnation, which is guarded by about, you know, 24 cops on Sunday. Except for the Church of the Incarnation, Uptown Dallas is dominated not so much by whites as by Iranians, Mexicans, and Asians. And that's
interesting you bring that up. There is a diner in that film, True Stories, and I looked up that diner on Google Maps, and it's been turned into a Mexican market, and then nearby is also like a Hindu temple. The place where the film was shot.
That's interesting. I mean, do you happen to know where the Hindu temple is? Because I never saw a Hindu temple there, even in my recent visit.
I don't. I'll look up right now. It's a diner that was used in the film. Hold on a second. It's just like a 1950s diner. It's where it's in Dallas, but the film was filmed there. I forget the name of it, but I'll look it up later. But one thing also that's interesting about the 1980s, there was sort of this culture. There was a culture of kind of the beginning of the culture of kind of crass materialism, but at the same time, it was sort of a lot more brutally honest than the culture of today.
Explain what you mean by that. I mean, that's interesting. That's not a thought that would have occurred to me. What do you mean by it was brutally honest compared to the culture of today?
Well, I'll give you a good example about today. Like, if you go into Whole Foods, it's a very, very expensive place, but there's a lot of stuff about, like charity, like donations to stuff in Africa. Like, it's kind of consumerism mixed with, like, social justice. But the 80s culture is a lot more honest.
I'd have to agree with that. I don't know. Lindsay, what would you call that? What do you call that when you go in to buy a $5 coffee or latte at Starbucks or something, and they tell you, this is from fair trade?
Well, of course, I love it, being a sort of a semi, little bit, kind of, sort of, maybe Marxist.
Well, I mean, how Marxist can you be when you're drinking a $5 coffee? Seriously.
Well,
I mean, would Lenin have ever done that?
Well, that's a more progressive capitalist, and I like that sort of capitalist better than a typical reactionary capitalist.
Why?
He's a capitalist, but he's helping social justice and all that. He's buying fair trade coffee, and that's the right thing to do.
It's in relation to Robert's point, is it honestly true?
It's more about being trendy than actually. I mean, income inequality today is far worse than it was in the 80s. In the 80s, we had a much stronger middle class, so it's not about being progressive. It's more about social status and proving your social status by how trendy you are.
That guy, Howard Schultz, is a little bit of a liberal or left winger. I don't understand it. But the only people who are going to get excited about fair trade coffee are liberal, progressive people, and most reactionaries are most only that snort or laugh or something, or say that or be against it. You know, so it's a good thing to be for, and businesses are usually just reactionary, and it's always cool to see them, you know, acting a little bit progressive. I like it. That's as good as the capitalist gets. That's as good as they get, basically. As good as you could expect them to get.
Today, I notice a lot of rich people sort of adopt kind of a pearl culture. Like, you see rich people who sort of adopt the culture of, like, trashy culture of, like, reality TV, and they're covered in tattoos. Like, my observation from watching movies from the 80s is that people back then tried to get into highbrow culture. Like, they depict the characters in the movies as, like, being into stuff like opera. I mean, Charles, as someone who's been around a lot of wealthy people back then, would you say that observation is accurate?
Well, I mean, I think that the upper class is still into opera as far as that goes. I don't think that's really changed. But I guess what you're really saying is that the culture of opera was still part of the general elite. Would that make sense? Whereas now it's been marginalized? Are you there?
Yeah. Like, basically, the whole theme of, like, reality TV culture is about people who have a lot of money but are really low class. And that's kind of what's celebrated these days.
Well, I mean, you know, there's the only moment at which opera intrudes into true stories is when this guy comes up on an empty stage, and he's actually, I think, the janitor or something, and he delivers a really beautiful rendition of Parisiamo from Rigoletto. You remember that scene? Parisiamo,
yeah.
La lingua e la pugnale, l'uomo sonia che ride e quel che spegne. And he's singing to no one, and he's nobody. And I think that, in a sense, that's a little bit of a hint that opera has become marginalized, and that it's, you know, the formerly high culture is only for the real essential in Texas. I think that you see that in terms of understanding the portrayal of cultural diversity in the movie, that's what that scene is saying, is that what Europe or New York might have called high culture is just marginalized to the point of some Italian janitor walking in and or maybe even as a Mexican and singing singing this wonderful, very famous aria, almost as good as Pavarotti. And I think that, you know, it isn't totally new. I mean, as early as the 1880s and 1890s, the French sociologist Émile Durkheim was writing about alienation, the feeling of alienation in society, which he called a feeling of lawlessness, basically a feeling of normlessness. The French word he used was anomie, the Greek negative, anomos, without law.
What did he mean? What did he mean by lawlessness?
Lacking in norms, lacking in law, life that lacks any kind of predictability, and because it lacks any kind of
like lawlessness, like no laws. You mean like outlaws?
He says lawlessness. He uses the term anomie, what it really comes down to is what we're talking about, a society of no values, where the old values have been completely suppressed, rejected, and nothing has taken their place.
And the other thing about the 80s is that you had that materialism, but at the same time there were still economic opportunities. You still had a strong middle class. We have this materialistic culture, but at the same time, there's no longer the economic opportunities. We're seeing basically the total destruction of the middle class. Well, in the 80s, like, I think a lot of the trends, you're starting to see sort of the policies that led to what we have now, but there was still a sort of remnants of that strong middle class that existed since at least the 1950s.
I'm going to say that I like the idea of lawlessness and normlessness and all that. I mean, you're talking to someone who grew up on the beach in Southern California, surfing, and a surf bum and a ski bum and a pothead and a pot dealer, and lived a hippie life. I was a hippie in the 1970s, and I was a punk in the 80s, and I've always just been an outlaw, you know, just anti-society, FTW, and always been into that culture. And I love the idea of no norms, no rules anymore. No, I mean, to me, that's great. That sounds cool.
Well, I mean, and you're talking to somebody who lived exactly the opposite life. My life was tremendously traditional. I went to church all the time. You know, attended my first Republican National Convention with my grandfather. Several after that, and I was president of College Republicans at Tulane, and was two terms. I was actually voted best dressed man on campus there. Sounds ridiculous these days. No one even thinks of. Well, I mean, I guess people still do dress pretty well at Tulane, but.
Yeah.
It's just a different world. And I mean, you may have enjoyed that life, but Durkheim's point was that it's much harder to form good families. It's much harder to form stable careers. It's much more difficult to know your place in the world to the point that the book where he talks most extensively about anomie is Emil Durkheim's book on suicide. And suicide is something that rose throughout the 19th century and has continued to rise through the 20th century all over the world as people get less and less connected to each other, less and less able to stay in families, less and less likely to have a sense of identity of any kind at all. And so, I mean, I'm glad you enjoyed your life, and I don't blame you for enjoying it. And
I still like to live that way. I still like to live that way. I still like to live that way, even though I'm supposedly an old man now. Well, I'm not really an old man. I'm getting there.
I'm 55. Robert is 30 months old. How are you? How old are you?
I'm 58. I'm even older than you are. See, I'm an old man.
Three years old.
If we're talking about the 80s, one thing we have to talk about is Ronald Reagan. And I guess both of you, neither of you are really fans of Ronald Reagan, but you're coming at it from slightly different angles. Charles is more of a traditionalist, and Robert Lindsay is an alternative left. But what's interesting about Ronald Reagan is you had all these middle-class white people who kind of saw him as their savior, and he was kind of symbolic as being kind of like all-American, but a lot of Reagan's policies actually led to the whole mess we are in today. And
I was about to mention something about the economy when in relation in the movie True Stories a few minutes ago, and now is as good time as any. One of the things that Reagan did that was so tremendously destructive was Reagan, after campaigning against reckless spending his entire life, became the most reckless spender in the history of the United States. And to the degree that there was a prosperity, a Reagan-era boom, it was entirely because of irresponsible government debt-based spending. And
so basically what happened is there was a short-term economic boom, but it led to the recession and economic decline that came later.
Well, what I was going to say was in True Stories, you see one of the immediate fruits of the Reagan-era credit policies, and that is the rich man who never speaks to his wife and only passes messages to his wife through his children at the family table. This guy, he's obviously a research, a real estate developer, because he takes David Byrne's character on a tour through a new development, which I'm almost positive is Plano. Plano basically was just a nothing little bus stop throughout most of the 1970s, if you even noticed it at all. And now it's like one of the largest cities in Texas, north of Dallas, in Collin County, north of Dallas. Anyhow, he's walking through this territory that looks very much like Plano before anything is built on it. And what it is it's miles and miles and miles of surveyed land where they're planning to build. And that is just mind-bogglingly real, because under Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush, the United States saw the most insane sustained spurt of pointless construction. It was all because of bank-driven easy credit to builders, and it was followed by bank-driven easy credit to buyers. And that, of course, by 2008, burst into the economic collapse and mortgage foreclosure epidemic that we've been suffering from ever since. And by the way, I'm just working with some people here in North San Diego County about getting a ballot petition started to outlaw nonjudicial foreclosure in California and try to restore the at least the level of private property that existed in California in the 1970s. But right now, the entire United States has been victimized by this boom of construction that started under Reagan in Texas, Florida, California, Arizona, Georgia, some of the worst hit states, but really just about everywhere except, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska, where nobody really wanted to live anyhow. We see this suburban sprawl that barely existed in the 1970s. I mean, people talked a little bit about it in the aftermath of desegregation and white flight, but
yeah,
the pattern...
I mean, you mentioned this on a previous show. The original subdivision was Levittown in Long Island. So it was.
Right.
It started in the 50s, but those 50s subdivisions were a lot smaller. Really, the 80s was when things really accelerated. But I remember, like, as a kid, driving down to San Diego, this was like the 90s, and through places like Carlsbad, and I just saw like wall-to-wall, like ugly track housing going up.
Yep. And in Florida, along the Gulf Coast of Florida, when I was in college at Tulane in the 1970s, we used to do camping trips out on the Florida Panhandle, and we could have basically, I mean... kind of, Robert Lindsay would have been very happy there. We had, you know, basically naked campouts on the beach because we had miles and miles of beach all to ourselves just because there was nobody there. And all those beaches have now been built up with condos and tract houses, 90% of which are either abandoned or in foreclosure. And that
at
is the product
we're...
of...
Well, at least where I live in Santa Barbara, they've at least avoided that disaster.
Well, I mean, you're living in one of the places that has been elite for a very long time, and Ronald Reagan knew better than to basically crap in his own backyard, I guess. You know, everybody, you see, in terms of the Reagan myth, I feel like Reagan was a complete myth, and indeed... from the conservative standpoint, a complete mistake, because he was advertised as a savior for the American middle class and the restoration of traditional, what Robert Lindsay would consider old-fashioned capitalism. But instead, what he did was he solidified the New Deal and the Great Society, and by inventing a totally new species of corporate welfare, manufactured much greater economic perversities as a result of credit than had ever existed before. George H.W. Bush continued that policy. Clinton, in his catastrophic presidency, continued that policy. W. Bush, in his even more catastrophic presidency, rapidly increased that policy, and now basically Obama is presiding, I guess, over the first years of, you know, what I guess a lot of us feel like is the permanent collapse and decline of the United States. It's very difficult to see how we're going to dig our way out of it. I don't know how you or Lindsay feel about that.
I think with Obama, to a lot of the right-wingers, Obama is symbolic of this sort of, they view him as a Muslim, mulatto, homosexual communist. That's not my words. That's their view of him.
Those are his best features, man.
What makes Reagan actually, in some ways, more dangerous is he's symbolic of sort of. Reagan was very sort of seen as the like ultimate like all American guy.
Yeah. And in that sense, he was a fraud. He was a total, complete fraud.
Well, you know, we hate him. We hate him.
Uh-huh.
We hate him. He's our enemy.
Well, tell me about your hatred. Does your hatred match mine, or what? How do you feel? What are the origins of
We hate Reagan. We hate him. He started the ruins. I mean, he started the right-wing backlash 30 years ago.
Lindsay, can you talk a little bit more specifically about Reagan's policies and what you hate about his policies?
Well, he started the modern conservative movement. And, it's been going ever since. And before, it wasn't around. Before, Republicans or conservatives were people like Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, people like that. And nowadays, those are like liberal Democrats. You know, he started this whole crazy reactionary, the new conservative movement, and it's ruined the country. You know, and it continued through Bush's father. Clinton basically continued Reaganism pretty much. I mean, he kind of modified it as sort of like a liberal Reaganism.
Well, Clinton accelerated Reagan's policies. If you look at Reagan's policies, Reagan started free trade, but he started free trade with Japan, Taiwan, and Korea, which were relatively well-off countries. But then Clinton opened up free trade to mainland China. And then Reagan started deregulating Wall Street, but then Clinton made it even worse by getting rid of Glass-Steagall. And then the immigration levels were pretty much, like, we had an Immigration Act of 65, but throughout the 70s, immigration was about, like, 400,000 a year. And then under Reagan and Bush Sr., it really accelerated to, like, what, 1 million a year.
Well, and don't forget, Reagan did the first big amnesty, the Simpson-Mazzoli Act of 86. I mean, Reagan is the one who really fundamentally transformed Texas and California into parts of Mexico.
Yeah, well, I'd like to say about Glass-Steagall, everybody blames Clinton and blames the Democrats, but guess what? 100% of the Republicans supported it. I mean, that was a bipartisan bill. They all went for it, you know? All the conservatives went for it. Of course, it's a conservative idea. Clinton went for it. A whole bunch of Democrats went for it. A whole bunch of liberal Democrats voted for that, too, because Reaganism is hip now, you know? Even liberal Democrats are Reaganites. Everybody's a Reaganite, you know? Obama's a Reaganite. Reagan's a zero, see? See? Clinton, best Republican president we ever had. He got rid of welfare. Even Reagan wouldn't do that. I saw the 1984 presidential debates, and it was Reagan and whoever was running with him.
Mondale? No, Bush Sr.
Well, who was who was Reagan's vice president? I don't even know.
Bush Sr. George H.W. Bush. George Herbert Walker.
Yeah,
Bush.
Well, anyway, the Reagan people were saying something like, well, we're not talking, we would never consider getting rid of welfare. I mean, no, of course not. That's just like talking about the Holocaust or something like that. Just thought it is that's a horrible idea. Hey, you know, and Clinton comes in and just wipes it out, man. He's a liberal Democrat. See what I mean? I mean, Reaganism just accelerated. It got worse and worse and worse. And this latest one with George Bush Jr., he's the nuttiest, craziest, most reactionary of them all. You know, they've just been getting more and more right. They've been moving further and further to the right. They moved the goalposts. And every year they moved the goalposts, and they moved this thing called the Overton window to where something that was 10 years ago was totally insane. Now the conservatives say, hey, this is normal. This is normal. This totally insane idea 10 years ago is presented as the most normal thing in the world. And it's called the Overton window. You keep moving the center more and more to the right, and things that were totally crazy not too long ago are now seen as like sliced bread or something.
You realize that some people classify the Overton window as perpetual movement to the left, don't you?
Well, it can move either way, you know, really.
Yeah.
Well,
liberals talk about it to the right.
On cultural issues like homosexuality and feminism, it's moving to the left.
I think on cultural issues, the left is moving the damn Overton window to the left. That's absolutely true. I would agree with conservatives on that. And that is an Overton window thing. You know, the stuff that was totally crazy 20 years ago is now normal. Now normal. You can choose your gender. Did you know that? Charles, you can choose your gender. Barbara, you can choose your gender.
I chose mine a long time ago, and I'm quite happy with it. Thank you.
Not only that, but you can switch your gender.
I
you could be male on Monday, female on Tuesday.
We've covered a lot of great topics. I'd like to thank Charles and Lindsay for being on.
All a great pleasure, Robert. But I haven't even sung the final song from True Stories yet. Should I start that now? No, but you've got to understand that the song ends, "People Like Us," sung by John Goodman. In 1950, when I was born, Papa couldn't afford to buy us much. He said, "Be proud of what you are. There's something special about people like us. People like us.
People like us.
Who won't answer the telephone. People like us. Growing big as a house. People like us make it because we don't want freedom. We don't want justice. We just want someone to love. Someone to love."
We are out of time, so that's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.